Hello and welcome to Viewpoints. My name is Boris Chassagne. I'll be with you for the next half hour. On today's show, human trafficking is on the rise in Canada and the numbers in Halifax seem to be the worst in the country. But this increase in reported cases could also mean that victims are more oftenly seeking help.
A lot of the victims from Nova Scotia will be taken through from Halifax or other parts of Nova Scotia up to Moncton, New Brunswick, because that's the closest place where legal strip clubs run.
Citizens of Shelburne, Nova Scotia do not want their South Shore riding to be split in two, detailed a federal commission to go back to the drawing board.
And so when you take one and you slice a chunk out of it, it's sort of like cutting the heart out of your community. So I think that's why you saw the passion here tonight saying, I know you got this problem up there in Halifax, but don't take it out on us.
Turtles and Tods in Revelstok, BC do not seem to mind the traffic as they bask under the sun while cars pass by.
The turtles have such strong site fidelity. They want to keep coming back to the same spot, even though it's really not ideal habitat. Like, you have the road right there.
And summer's back with a revenge in Smithers, BC, the Midsummer Festival. Just can't wait.
We are so excited to see this come back. Now, of course, we're having to keep an eye on the river. And, there's always got to be something, but we just can't wait.
Welcome to Viewpoints.
Follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI. Listen to all our news online at canada-info.ca.
A report from Statistics Canada released in May of 2019 shows that Halifax had the highest rate of police-reported human trafficking in the country. At more than 10 incidents per 100,000 people, it's 7.5 times higher than the national average rate. Senior Crown Attorney Josie McKinney of the Nova Scotia Public Prosecution Service specializes in human trafficking. Her role is to take cases after the police have investigated them and to guide victims through the court process. Our reporter Sarah Gouda had a long conversation with Josie McKinney. In this interview, McKinney sheds light on misconceptions about human trafficking, recruiting, talks about the situation in Nova Scotia, and shares methods of prevention.
So where in Canada are the most reported cases of human trafficking, or is it Ontario?
So the sheer number of cases that are reported is in Ontario. Nova Scotia has the highest rate of human trafficking, and that's the rate of human trafficking is a reflection of the number of reported incidents per every 100,000 people. So our rate is higher because we have more reported incidents per population. It's difficult to say why Nova Scotia would have a higher rate of human trafficking. It's important to keep in mind that the Statistics Canada, whose reports on the rates of human trafficking, is including charges under the Criminal Code of Human Trafficking and charges of human trafficking under the Immigration and Refugee Protection Act. So those are two different pieces of legislation. So the Immigration and Refugee Protection Act charges under that legislation account for, I think, something like 30 or 40% of all reported cases in Nova Scotia. And what that would certainly be a sign of is that Nova Scotia, particularly Halifax, being a point of entry into the country, would be a contributing factor to those numbers. Nova Scotia is a part of a corridor to bringing victims into other parts of the country. So a lot of the victims from Nova Scotia will be taken through from Halifax or other parts of Nova Scotia up to Moncton, New Brunswick, because that's the closest place where legal strip clubs run. Traffickers will try out a victim in Moncton first, and if the person is successful there, then they'll transport them to other provinces like Quebec, Ontario, Alberta, or Newfoundland, which is known as the circuit.
How do human traffickers get their victims? Does it happen during the day, during the night? How do they target these young men and women?
Part of the challenge, I think, is folks have a false image about what human trafficking looks like, which is that they think people are being taken, like the movie Taken, or that they're being pulled off the street or captured, kidnapped, those sorts of things. That's extremely rare. Most human trafficking happens through what's called the boyfriend method, which is a trafficker befriending or building an initial relationship with someone who's going through a difficult time in their life. And then in that, they shower them with attention and affection and make that person feel like This is the greatest boyfriend they've ever had. And then that relationship is then transitioned into an exploitive relationship once they've earned that victim's trust. So it's actually a very long seductive process as opposed to a violent or volatile process. It doesn't mean that violence won't eventually become a part of the equation, but a lot of the cases that we see both in Nova Scotia and elsewhere are mental and emotional coercion and manipulation.
What are the ages you're seeing for human trafficking? What are the most common ages from youngest to oldest?
So on a national level, the average age for victims is 18 to 25. That's the age range that's targeted the most. In my experience in Nova Scotia, I'm seeing victims much younger than 18. So we're seeing teenagers ages 13 to 18 seems to be the most common age range that we're experiencing in our active prosecutions right now. So essentially children.
What are the top risk factors for victims of human trafficking?
I think it's important for people to keep in mind that any person can be targeted by a trafficker, child, adult, male, female, non-binary. Certainly any person can be targeted, but certainly traffickers do prey people in society that we have marginalized, that society has marginalized and made more vulnerable because of systemic discrimination. So we do see girls and gender diverse folks, so members of the 2SLGBTQ plus community are targeted. Women, girls from the Indigenous and African Nova Scotian communities are targeted more often. And again, that's because we as a society have marginalized those communities. And so traffickers feel like they're not going to be looked for or missed.
I'm curious. So over the years, human trafficking has been increasing, not decreasing, or even remaining stagnant. I wonder, is that because, is there a lack of information? Is there a lack of resources? What is the reason that it's increasing?
Those increase in numbers that we're seeing could also be a reflection of people trusting in that system now to come forward and increased awareness. So there will be, I think, we can expect a time as we continue to build public awareness and then we continue to improve the way that we respond, we are going to see an increase in reported cases. That doesn't necessarily mean actual human trafficking is increasing. Human trafficking, it is not going to look like what you think it is. It's not going to look like people being kidnapped and held in cages. It is going to be manipulative relationship. Almost always it's going to be that manipulative relationship by a trafficker or someone pretending to be a boyfriend or a loved one. So that's the first misconception. The second misconception is that it is only people from quote unquote certain communities. Any child or adult can be trafficked. It could be anyone.
That report was produced by Sarah Gouda in Halifax, Nova Scotia. You can listen or download the complete 20-minute interview conducted with attorney Josie McKinney on canada-info.ca. That's canada-info.ca. And we stay in Nova Scotia, where citizens of Shelburne want to keep their riding and argue with a federal commission that their city must stay in the South Shore riding they have always been part of. The commission's mandate is to distribute Nova Scotia's population equally amongst the 11 seats. The Nova Scotia Electoral Boundaries Commission members listened to citizens' feedback at a public meeting in Bridgewater on June 9th. Rick Perkins, Member of Parliament for South Shore St. Margaret's, was the first to speak, and he talked at length about the historical and cultural ties between Shelburne and the rest of the South Shore. More with Ed Alverson in Liverpool, Nova Scotia.
Residents delivered a message loud and clear: keep Shelburne in the South Shore. The Federal Electoral Boundaries Commission held a hearing in Bridgewater to discuss how riding lines will be redrawn across the province. The commission's mandate is to try to distribute Nova Scotia's population equally amongst 11 seats. To accommodate population growth in Halifax, the commission proposed extending the South Shore St. Margaret's riding further into the city to include areas up to Sambro and moving Shelburne into the newly named Acadian Shores riding along with Yarmouth and Digby. All the just over a dozen people who addressed the Boundaries Commission said Shelburne must remain part of the South Shore. The current Member of Parliament for South Shore St. Margaret's, Rick Perkins, was first to speak. Perkins talked at length about the historical and cultural ties between Shelburne and the rest of the South Shore.
And so when you take one and you slice a chunk out of it, it's sort of like cutting the heart out of your community. So I think that's why you saw the passion here tonight saying, I know you got this problem up there in Halifax, but don't take it out on us.
Almost everyone who spoke at the hearing discussed the importance of keeping communities of interest together, communities that share not just history and culture, but also industries and attitudes. Perkins says that's why he proposes keeping Shelburne in the South Shore riding as it has been for 50 years and moving areas such as Timberley and Hubley into a city riding. Perkins says that doesn't mean he doesn't want to serve his constituents in those areas.
I'm happy to represent anyone that's, you know, living in whatever riding I'm lucky enough to represent. The challenge is balancing those issues that you have to do, because the perspectives of urban people and suburban people in a large city like Halifax versus small communities like ours, they do have different perspectives. And you try to balance them, but it's difficult.
Elections Canada reassesses riding boundaries across the country every 10 years to ensure Canadians receive equal and fair representation. Based on the 2021 census results, each riding in Nova Scotia should represent 88,000 people. Under special circumstances, that number can be adjusted up or down by 25%, so an electoral district can have no fewer than 66,000 and no more than 110,000 people. Commission Chair Justice Cindy Bourgeois says they've received the message that their proposal is focused too much on numbers and doesn't reflect the reality of the communities on the ground.
So the Commission is going to go back. We're going to listen to the information that we've received both here and at other meetings across the province and see whether we can come up with a revised plan for the boundaries that not only respect the numbers that we have to in terms of the the equivalency of the number of voters in each riding, but also take into consideration other nuances that maybe we didn't appreciate as much until we heard from people who actually live in the various communities. And that's what the process is supposed to do.
Nova Scotians can register to speak at a province-wide virtual public hearing to be held June 27th. Anyone who wishes can provide feedback to the Commission until June 28th. The Commission will then have until the end of the year to finalize their proposed electoral boundary changes. I'm Ed Halverson.
Hey, I'm Anastasia Avakumova in beautiful British Columbia, and you are tuned to Viewpoints. Follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI and get all our stories on canada-info.ca.
The Western Painted Turtle is an endangered species whose habitat spreads west from Ontario. These turtles like to bask under the sun. The problem is the traffic. The turtles lay their eggs every spring on Red Devil Hill, a steeper curve above the Columbia River on Airport Way and Revelstoke, British Columbia. They cross the busy road and enjoy taking breaks on the warm asphalt. Volunteers such as Aviva Falco, who manages the Wild Site organization in Revelstoke, BC, says they want to use camera traps to monitor how turtles are laying eggs. This data could also be used to contribute to more protective measures for the turtles during the nesting season. Our journalist Megan Dooling went and looked for nesting turtles with Aviva Falco, and they found one, despite the rain.
My name is Aviva Falco, and I work for Wild Site Revelstoke. So we're on Red Devil Hill on Airport Way, which is a very popular Western Painted Turtle nesting site. And so it's close to the water on the west side.
A cement barrier runs along the top of Red Devil Hill before it goes down towards the river.
We're walking on the shoulder of the road, and it's kind of a busy, curvy road.
Yeah, it's very busy, definitely a high traffic area, lots of cars frequently going up and down, tons of people either, you know, who live in Arrow Heights or on their way to recreate at Sunnyside and Mount Cartier. So we are looking for Western Painted Turtles. I saw two a few minutes ago. They are nesting in this area, and I haven't seen any eggs yet myself, but it is likely that they've laid them already or will be laying their eggs in the next few days, but we don't want to disturb the site. So, oh, there's one right there, actually. There's a turtle.
We see a turtle. Her belly's burrowed in a dusty dirt nest. Her feet are tucked into her shell, and she's pulling in her head, too. An orange rim lines the outer edge of her shell.
Lovely lady here. We can see the western painted turtle. So on the top, they have a green solid shell, and then their body and then their stomach have some beautiful orange and yellow on them. And we're not going to pick her up, but if you could see her stomach, they have a really cool pattern called a plastron, and each plastron is unique for each turtle. And so it's a really good way of identifying them. But because she's in the process of potentially laying eggs and nesting, we don't want to disturb her. We're just going to let her do her thing.
Yeah, she's kind of tucking her feet in. I feel a little bit like I'm invading her privacy.
To the west of Red Devil Hill, we have, you know, the Airport Marsh and Cartier Bay area in the drawdown zone. And this is a really popular area for western painted turtles, and they do overwinter in it. It is a pretty unique ecosystem, and western painted turtles are a species at risk. They're listed under Schedule 1 of the Federal Species at Risk Act. That's why we really want people to go out and about and start counting them when they see them. And noting different nest sites, because we're trying to get a better idea of the population size. They're reptiles, but yeah, they are very funny, and they actually move very fast. And so there's been a few times where I've come up behind them when they've been on the road to encourage them to cross, and they do move very quick. Like, people say, you know, turtles are really slow, but if you actually see one on the move, they're pretty speedy. And their eggs are very fragile, so that's why we are not wanting people to walk on the gravelly side of Red Devil Hill, because you don't want to disturb the nests since the eggs are so delicate. It's because the turtles have such strong site fidelity. They want to keep coming back to the same spot, even though it's really not ideal habitat. Like, you have the road right there and then a steep embankment, and it just doesn't seem very nice. If I was a turtle, I'd kind of prefer somewhere more chill, but to each their own.
But I mean, I guess it's, they probably were laying their eggs there before the road was built, so.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, and that's why you got to admire their stubbornness. They really seem to like this spot, and they were laying their eggs here before the roads were built. And that is why, you know, we really look to organizations like the Ministry of Transportation and others to help play a role in helping these species, because roads are a big impact on a lot of wildlife here, because roads fragment their habitat. And so for species like the western painted turtle or like the western toad, when they're migrating from upland forested habitat down into wetlands and you have a road in the middle, the chances of them dying due to road mortalities are significantly higher.
Where should people be looking out for toads?
For toads, I would say the 4-kilometer stretch from Airport Way and like Catherwood Road down to the Cartier Recreation Site. And then for the turtles, Red Devil Hill, Arrow Heights sort of area.
Like, how do you document the squished toads?
So I have been using an app called Gaia GPS.
And she uses an app to record the toads they see in a night,
whether or not they're male or female and their direction of travel.
She records a D for the dead ones she finds. She used the data to trace out a pink line on the map in her phone.
So this stretch here is this like pink line here. That's where the toads have been migrating.
They had hundreds of observations of toads throughout the season. Aviva trains volunteers to go out and gather data. They've been going out on 2-hour toad watch shifts since April. There have been 70 watches.
The end goal is to inform the future installation of a little wildlife underpass. So if we know the really high mortality spots, and we've been documenting evidence for a number of years, we can then give that information over to the Ministry of Transportation for when they need to redo the road, because it is a very expensive project to undertake, and they've indicated that it's likely that it wouldn't happen until the road needs to be redone. There's been really slow nights on toad watch on the really cold nights, but hardly any are moving. But then when it's too hot, it's also kind of the same case. So, and the nights when it's rained, it's been a really amazing show of Revelstoke's biodiversity. We've seen snakes and salamanders and birds and frogs and slugs and snails. Everything kind of comes out along Airport Way, so it's not.
I'm Megan Dooling.
So if you happen to travel to BC this summer and pass through Smithers, British Columbia on Canada Day weekend, it might be fun to plan for a camping weekend during the 39th Midsummer Festival this July. The Midsummer Music Festival is an annual three-day celebration of music from the Balkley Valley and beyond. In years past, the festival curated musical acts from a multitude of genres, pop, rock, punk, country, jazz, electronic, but this year is a return to the festival's folk roots. Headliners include Tom Jackson, Rachelle Van Zanten, and the Valley Youth Fiddlers. Tina Day is the president of the Balkley Valley Folk Music Society Board and an active hands-on volunteer. She had a chat with Pamela Hassan about the festival and how to best prepare to attend this year's edition.
Our performance committee has worked really hard at pulling together a great lineup, and we've really focused on local regional acts this year because, as we all know, festivals haven't been a thing that's been happening, and we just really wanted to highlight the talent that we have here in our community as well as BC. So some of the headliners that we have coming are Tom Jackson. He's a triple threat activist, actor, musician, so we're super excited to have him coming. Monkey Dragon, Rachel Van Zanten, The Mavens, Earth Child. It's also the Valley Youth Fiddlers' 25th anniversary this year, so we're looking to highlight them as well, and they're bringing some of their mentors with them, so Emily Stamm, Jerome Freeman Fox, David Lapp, and James Steffens will be here, so we're really excited to have them all here as part of our lineup.
Excellent, and I know too that with this, because this is the 39th, right? So that means it's the last year before you reach that major milestone of 40th. So what I notice in the lineup is that it's almost like, yeah, it is celebrating those regionals, locals, BC, and also really having that folk feel about it. Do you have kids performers this year as well, or any special kid stuff this year?
We've got the kids performers. We also have Eric the Juggler, who's going to be there. No, so it's going to be great. Yeah, we have a youth zone. So if you have any youth that feel like they might want to volunteer for hours to get a youth pass, have them get a hold of us, and I'll give some contact information in a bit.
What is the feeling of the board and the volunteers with the return of the festival this year, since there was so much struggle to can we, can't we in the past 2 years with the pandemic? What's the general feeling?
You know what? We're all super excited. Like, it's been a long 2 years, and we are so excited just to see this come back. Now, of course, we're having to keep an eye on the river, and there's always got to be something, but we just can't wait. Like, it's just, the level of excitement is just incredible, and, the work that everybody's putting in is just amazing.
Yeah. And so how can people best prepare themselves to come to Midsummer this year? Insofar as camping or things that they need to bring, things you do and don't allow there. I know that you try to kind of keep garbage down too. So can you just give some highlights of how people who want to come, traveling or locals, what can they do to best have the be ready for Midsummer this year?
Yeah, so we are having camping this year. It's $10 a head per person for anyone over the age of 19. Youth have to camp with their family members. They can't be off in a little group by themselves. And then we are a Glassview Festival. We have a lot of animal users down the grounds. We need to keep that free. No bicycles, dogs, stereos, those kinds of things are allowed on the grounds. But, bring yourself, bring your great attitude, bring your dancing shoes, because it's going to be a good party.
And I'm hoping, too, that it's a necessity to have sunscreen and big hats, because I would love it if it was just a beautiful, sunny weekend as well.
Thanks for jinxing us. I was trying not to.
Fine. Redacted.
I was going to say that, and then I was like, nope, that's just too much.
Okay.
Yeah, just bring stuff to be prepared for all weather. And, we have a great variety of stages, some inside, some outside. And, we're really hoping for great weather.
Okay, so where can people find tickets? Either online or in town, what's the best way for people to get tickets? And could you also just give the prices of weekend versus day pass if you have that information?
Adult weekend passes are just $80. Mm-hmm. So I'd have to go back on the website and look. But tickets are available at Midsummer, or at Mountain Eagle Books, here in Smithers. You can also purchase them online at smithersmusicfest.com. As well as, you can find in there any information you want on the performers, camping, any of our kind of regulations. And if you really like to volunteer, we have a volunteer application in there, and we are looking for volunteers in all hour in all areas. So if you do a 4-hour shift, yeah, you get a free pass for that day. 12 hours gets you a free weekend pass, and if you get to be 24 hours, then you get a weekend pass and delicious meals. So,
and I know from experience, those meals are delicious as well. Yes. With the return of Karen DeMart doing the food too, which is awesome.
Yeah. So we're super excited to have her here. And yeah, it's just going to be a really great time. We also have Work Bees happening at the fairgrounds now. So every Saturday from now until festival, if people want to meet down at the fairgrounds at the building, we're down there at 10 o'clock and we can use help moving things, washing walls. And we'll be doing those. And then the 28th to the 30th. And then takedown is on July 4th. So we need help in sort of all areas.
Yeah.
Yeah, you'd be hanging out with a great group of people and, having a great time.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Tina. And if you want to follow Midsummer on Facebook as well, it's Smithers Music Fest on Facebook, right? And Instagram. Thanks a lot, Tina.
Excellent. Thank you.
And during the summer season, you might be wary of ticks transmitting Lyme disease. Well, we might suggest two very useful reports produced by our journalists. You can have a tick talk with journalist Sarah Gouda, working out of Halifax, Nova Scotia, who had a chat with Amal El-Naboot, a PhD candidate at Dalhousie University, and who knows her ticks.
The long-term effects of tick bites are usually muscle pain, joint pain, fatigue, headaches, mental fog, difficulty with memory or finding different words like that you're looking for, sleeplessness, things like that.
So do ticks die after they get engorged in our skin?
So usually after they're feeding, they become engorged and they fall off the body. After falling off, they stay somewhere in the leaf litter, they lay their eggs, and after laying the eggs, they die. But you don't want to know how many eggs they lay.
How many eggs do they lay?
Each one at least 2,000.
Oh, wow.
Exactly.
And journalist Taylor McClure in Knowlton, Quebec, met with the creator of the national e-tick platform. That's Bishop's University professor and tick expert Jade Savage. She confirms, as does Mrs. Naboot, that there seem to be more ticks not only in Quebec's eastern townships where she works, but all over the country. Ticks can not only transmit Lyme disease, but also anaplasmosis, another bacteria-borne disease. Symptoms typically begin within 1 to 2 weeks after the bite of an infected tick. Early symptoms include fever, chills, severe headaches, muscle aches, nausea, and if it goes untreated, it can lead to respiratory failure, organ failure, and even death. E-Tick is a public platform for image-based identification and population monitoring of ticks in Canada.
Citizens of all the provinces can now get a quick identification, and they also receive information that is relevant to a tick bite for their own province. Because health being administered at the provincial level, there are different directives provided to citizens depending on what species they came across with.
So stay safe during the tick season. That's it for us at Viewpoints. We thank our journalists Pamela Hassan, Sarah Gouda, Taylor McClure, Megan Dooling, Ed Halverson, and our national coordinator Maureen McEwen. To the artists who help us out with their music, many thanks as always. Viewpoints is produced by the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Remember that you can follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI, CanadaLJI, and tune in to all our stories on canada-info.ca. My name is Boris Chassaigne. It was a pleasure to have you with us. We'll be back next week. Ciao.